From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday, and I'm Joe Palca. This hour, we're talking about Mars. My guests are Jim Bell, professor of astronomy at Cornell University and science leader for the Mars rover PanCam team, and Dave Spencer. He's the deputy project manager for the Phoenix mission to Mars at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Jim Bell, coming back to you, we were talking about the fact that the rover is sitting. The Opportunity is sitting waiting to go into this big crater. What's that all about?
Well, one of the main highlights of the past few months with the Opportunity rover is getting it, after more than 2 years of driving, getting it to this enormous impact crater called Victoria, which is it's about a half a mile across, so you could fit a reasonable-sized college campus inside. And as we've been driving around, we've seen these just spectacular layered cliffs, 30, 50 feet high, sheer cliffs in places, and we can see these beautiful exposed layers in them, and we've been able to follow these layers around the perimeter of the crater for the part that we've driven around. And, you know, one of the things that we use craters for is sort of a nature's road cut, a way to see into the subsurface. The rover can't dig very much with its wheels, but we can let Mother Nature do the digging with an asteroid or a comet, creating these big holes in the ground, and we can actually see the record of the rocks exposed in the walls of these craters, almost like, you know, in the Grand Canyon or something like that. And so we want to get Opportunity down there and traverse down into the crater and read these layers and see if that watery history that we saw at Eagle Crater and Endurance Crater continues deeper into the subsurface.
Okay. Well, let me invite our listeners to join this conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255. And let's go first to Stefan in Miami. Stefan, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, that's Stefan.
Oh, Stefan. Okay, well, sorry about that. What's your question?
I was just wondering, the next time, I guess it's too late for the rovers, but the next time someone sends one of these probes up to Mars that might have these solar panels on them, I heard that a gust of wind saved them the last time, but how about maybe something like a windshield wiper to just wipe it off?
Interesting. Yeah. Go ahead, Jim Bell.
No, that's a great question. I give a lot of talks, and someone asks that question in every talk I give. It's a really good question. And the answer is, might not be as obvious as you'd think. It's not because it's hard to build a wiper blade or a dust-off device of some kind like that, but the answer is it's a zero-sum game. If you want to put some kind of a gizmo on to wipe the solar panels off, you got to throw something else off. It's only so much mass and volume you can fit in these rockets. And so what do you throw off? You throw off a camera? Do you get rid of a redundant radio transmitter? You know, what do you give up to get that capability? And we decided, the team decided early on, that we would not give something up. We wouldn't put that kind of a device on and just take the chance that each of the rovers would survive 90 days.
90 days, yeah.
And by golly, they did, and we're today it's 1,267 days later, and we're still surviving.
Unbelievable.
Have we gotten a little bit lucky? Yeah, Stefan, you're right. Sometimes the wind blows your way, and you know that's just been a lucky break. But so that's really the answer.
Okay, Stefan, thanks for that call. Dave Spencer, I wonder if I can ask you: is Phoenix also susceptible to dust storms, or will that not be a problem?
Well, we're landing in late northern spring on Mars, and from our observations of Mars, we know that historically that's not a high time for dust storms. Or I don't think there have been any dust storms recorded at that time of year, so we think we're pretty safe. But if there were to be a massive dust storm like what MER is hunkering down through at the present time, it would pose a problem for us. You know, we're a soft lander. We land on three landing legs and use rocket engines to slow ourselves down, and so stability during the landing event is very important to us, and a gust of wind at the wrong time would pose a hazard to us.
I really like, Dave, you're obviously a NASA hand, because nobody but NASA people refer to the rovers as MER anymore, but that was its original name, the Mars Exploration Rovers, and everybody in the media said, no, we can't do that. MER is just not a good name. Funny. Okay, well, let's take another call then, and how about if we go to Mike in Carlisle. Mike, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question on the age of the ice on Mars. Is there any instrumentation on board that will allow you to determine that?
Huh. Dave Spencer?
We're not going to be able to determine the age of the ice directly, but we will, we think, be able to see layering in the ice that will allow us to deduce some indication of the cycles, a number of cycles of ice deposition on Mars, and from that extrapolate approximate ages of the ice.
Yeah, Joe, that's a really good question. Mike, that's a really good question. On the rover missions, one of the most frustrating parts of our experience is that we have no way to tell the ages of the rocks and soils. And, of course, if we were on the Earth, we would be taking samples and bringing them back to big laboratories and doing the age dating that geologists do on the Earth. But so far, no one's figured out how to turn those room-sized laboratories into a shoebox so we can get them onto a rover, although people certainly are working on that.
Okay. How about another call now? And let's try Brian in Yorktown. Brian, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you very much. My question is about the future mission to Mars. I believe it was Saul Kripke wrote a famous paper about twin Earth, and you can look at water in at least two different ways, one of being HOH or H2O with the chemical composition of water that we have here on Earth, and one of being a substance which functions in the same way that water may function in an alien ecosystem. So my question is, when the new probe is going to Mars to the polar ice caps and it will be analyzing the chemical composition of the water there, is it going to be examining something which shares the same chemical composition as our water H2O, or is the interest to see if this substance frozen in the ice caps there may have served in some ancient ecosystem to fulfill the same function as water would on our planet Earth?
Wow, that's an interesting question. Dave, do you want to take a swing at that?
I'll take a crack at that. It is a fascinating question. You know, we expect that water on Mars is basically the same as water on Earth. And our instruments will be able to detect not only water, but of course numerous other elements, some of which form the building blocks for life. But you know, I don't have the scientific background to be able to distinguish what other types of water would be potentially in existence on Mars. But you know, we'll be certainly looking at the chemical makeup of those.
Hey, Jim Bell, any thoughts? I don't know how much you get into ice. You're more of a geology guy.
Well, no, it's a really good question, and I guess I'd expand a little bit on Dave's answer in that, you know, we've observed water on Mars in ice in the polar caps.
That's H2O water?
We've observed it in the atmosphere.
Sorry, Brian was asking if that was H2O water.
It's known to be H2O water. And we've seen at the rover sites the remnant evidence that there was liquid water on the surface. We see some of that water as H2O and OH tied up in some of the minerals that are there now. And so we know that there was liquid water in the Martian environment. We know that there is a small bit of water vapor and water ice there. But I think the nice thing about instruments on Phoenix and then the follow-on Mars Science Laboratory is that they're going to have flexibility for other kinds of materials too, whether it's you know, isotopic variations of water or CO2 ice or other kinds of ices. I think the instrumentation that's sent will sort of keep an open mind to other possible ice phases that could be there.
Brian, thanks very much. Interesting question. Let's take another call now and go to Nathan in Prosser. Prosser is where, Nathan?
That's in Central Washington.
Oh, excellent. Okay, what's your question?
Wine country.
Great. Welcome to the program. What's your question?
Thank you. Yes, I just had a question in regards to a large dust storm. Have you guys really foreseen any opportunities after the dust has subsided and settled down that any geological formations or any other minerals that were below the dust at one point could now at this point be accessible to any of the rovers?
Hey, that's a great question. It usually works the other way. Usually the dust, which is very amorphous, fine-grained, iron-bearing minerals, usually that settles out on top of the rocks and sand dunes and soils and things and prevents us from seeing the intrinsic composition of those materials, which is why we brought a little brush on the arm and an abrasion tool to get below the dust. But it's also true that because it's windy, sometimes the dust gets redistributed and moved around, and it can uncover darker materials or scour rock surfaces. And so we're certainly taking many measurements at both rover sites sort of before and after, monitoring the terrain, looking for changes around us as a result of these dust storms. And then there's a large group of people on the team who are really atmospheric scientists who are interested in the dust itself and how the dust changes the climatology, the weather of Mars today. And so some of the instruments on the rovers are getting at that as well.
Interesting. Nathan, thanks for that call. Let's go now to Nick in New Hampshire. Nick, welcome to Science Friday.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a conversation a couple years ago with a woman who was working on Phoenix, and she said one of the big problems that they were having was trying to figure out how to sterilize the electrochemical analytical equipment, because those things tend to not be very liking of heat or radiation or anything like that. So very practical question here. Have you ever resolved that problem? Have you been able to get around it? How did you sterilize that equipment? It's been bugging me ever since.
Bugging, that's a good word.
Yeah. Exactly.
Dave Spencer, what about that? How clean did you get it, and how clean did it have to be?
Well, we do wipes of all of the alcohol wipes, basically, of all of the instruments, and get them as clean as we possibly can. And we try to meet planetary protection requirements, which basically ensure that we're not taking Earth microbes to Mars at a level that would allow them to prosper, because we don't want to find Earth life when we're looking for life on Mars. But another thing that we've added just in the past year to the Phoenix mission is an organic free blank. This is a basically tablet of silica material that we're going to sample early in the mission and deliver this sample to the analytic instruments. And when they measure this material, they should see very low levels of organics, if any. And therefore, if we do see high levels of organics from the Martian material that we're sampling, we effectively have a laboratory basis for understanding the difference between those two.
Interesting. But there's no, I mean, is there some limit that's set that how many, you know, microbes per square millimeter you're allowed to take with you?
Yes, there are. You can never get perfectly clean, and we do work to a planetary protection requirement in terms of number of microbes per square centimeter.
I got it. Okay, Nick, thanks very much for that call.
Thank you much.
Okay. You know, one thing I want to get out to ask Dave Spencer before, you know, we get off, well, about the mission in general is... this is a soft landing mission, first one in 30 years. NASA's had three, you know, successes in a row with the bounce down method. Why switch?
Yeah, well, the Phoenix mission was actually competitively proposed back in the 2003 timeframe, and it's a PI-led mission, principal investigator-led mission from University of Arizona. And the proposal was based on utilizing the Mars 2001 lander hardware that was set aside after the Mars Polar Lander failed. Mars Polar Lander used a similar design and was also designed to be a soft lander, and that mission failed, and we didn't have a good explanation for it. So the foundation of this Phoenix mission was to use that hardware that was set aside in 2001 and really test the heck out of it over the intervening years to drive out as much risk as possible and make this landing as reliable as possible.
Okay. Well, we're talking with Jim Bell from the Cornell University and Dave Spencer from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory about the Mars missions that are and the Mars missions that will be. We're taking your calls at 800-989-8255. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Dave Spencer, one other thing is... is that where the name came from, Phoenix? I sort of was thinking about that. I mean, it's sort of this is the mission that rose from the ashes there?
That's exactly the thought.
Okay.
You know, we had the Mars Polar Lander that didn't make it at the surface of Mars, and this is another attempt utilizing a very similar system. So we are, in effect, rising from the ashes of that.
I see. Okay. Let's take another call now and go to Greg from Boca Raton, Florida. Greg, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Well, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've always had this question, and it was touched on a little bit earlier, about why you tend to gravitate to craters. How do you differentiate, when you're at a crater, between the material that's around, especially rocks, of what's on the planet versus what was from the asteroid or meteorite that actually formed the crater?
Okay. Jim Bell, what about that?
Greg, that's a really good question. That's a question we have to constantly ask ourselves when we're driving around on craters or walking around on the Earth craters. The process that creates an impact crater is of course a violent explosion, and through either observing them form in like nuclear crater tests or modeling them in the computer, it's known that the impactor itself, most of it is completely vaporized in that process. However, you can sometimes get little pieces, little shards and remains of the original impactor, like if you walk around Meteor Crater in Arizona, you can find little magnetic pieces of rock from that iron-nickel meteorite that crashed there. And interestingly enough, we're seeing small pieces of iron-nickel meteorites in places around the plains of Meridiani, where the Opportunity rover is, and we've even found a few meteorites at the Spirit site in Gusev Crater. So it's likely that there still are some small pieces of either that impactor or others from the many craters that are preserved on Mars. But the vast majority, major majority of materials that we're seeing were dug out from the surface, dumped on top, and then they've been eroded since then. So not only do you have the confusion of that you brought up, but then you have erosion and time that's passing. And so you've got to sort out all of those different things. And that's sort of what we've been doing for the last few more trying to do for the last few months, 6 months or so with the Opportunity rovers, sort out the pieces of this puzzle that are sort of splayed out in front of us in this giant hole in the ground. And to really try to get at it much better, we need to go inside. So that's why we're poised and ready to go in.
Okay. Greg, thanks for that question. And Jim Bell, we only have just a short minute left, but before we leave, I have to ask you, is Spirit okay? That's the one around on the other side in Gusev Crater.
Yeah, no, it's important to point out both rovers are healthy. Both rovers are in good health. The problem is the environment. The problem is the weather. It's just that the sunlight is getting cut down, and that puts the rovers at risk of not being able to recharge their batteries and survive. And so it's really important for people to know that the rovers themselves are healthy. We're waiting out the weather. If anyone knows any good sun dances that'll work for Mars, please do them now.
I see.
And try to help out.
All right. Well, on that note, we'll send the Science Friday listeners out to do their best, whatever method they have of letting the sun shine in.
Excellent.
Jim Bell, thanks very much.
Thanks, Joe.
Jim Bell is professor of astronomy at Cornell University and science leader for the Mars Rover PanCam team. We were also speaking with Dave Spencer. He's the deputy project manager for the Phoenix mission to Mars at JPL. Stay with us. When we come back, we'll be talking with Dan Greenberg about politics and science. Don't go away. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.